Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. Hippocrates really ate with that one. Cooking and eating can be so healing for the body and the soul.
As a chef, I'm able to give other people love through food, people I don't know, and they're able to feel my love. And I think that's the most rewarding part of being a chef.
That's chef, business owner, teacher, and transplant recipient Chloe Gould. I'm Sarah Jane Castro, Senior Director of Marketing and Communications for the National Kidney Foundation of Illinois, and your host for this edition of The Journey Continues. Chloe, thank you so much for coming on The Journey Continues. Can you tell us how you fell in love with cooking?
I was 8 years old when I first started cooking. Food has always been a part of my life because I felt loved by food. I'm actually writing a book about how food became my therapy. I remember as a young girl going into the kitchen with my grandmother sitting around the table, and she wouldn't let me cook anything, I should say. She would allow me to cut like bell peppers, onions, and stuff like that. But you just had to be observant of her movements in the kitchen. I like to say she danced very well in the kitchen. She made things happen. We had 30 first cousins. So she had six kids. So it was a restaurant, right, at her house. I remember as a kid falling in love with food.
It sounds like it was sort of the centerpiece of your family life if everybody's gathered around grandma in her kitchen. How did you cultivate that love of food as you grew up and entered into adulthood and young adulthood?
I fell in love with food and food loved me back. I would like to say it was a food addiction. I was overweight my entire life until now, well, 3 years ago. So I was always on the cusp of obese or morbid obese or something like that. I would tell you, like, because I'm going to be very transparent and honest, that my childhood literally forced me into that relationship with food. My mom and I are now great friends and we have a great relationship, but then it was very tough. I felt like the outcast of the family. So I actually found love with food. I just literally started to develop what actually most would see as a bad relationship with food, but that was how I received love. I didn't feel like I received love in my house. And then so as I went on and graduated middle school and went on to high school, I was determined to go to a culinary arts program. And specifically, it was called home ec because I wanted to hold the babies. I wanted to learn how to sew. I ended up going to Dunbar Vocational Career Academy, which is where I fell in love like with what's professional. I entered into a culinary arts program. And so literally they entered me into a competition that year. My friend and I won a competition to compete in a gingerbread house building for O'Hare Hilton. And that was my first job in a professional kitchen at 15. So that is what segued my career. I got the taste, I got the feel of what a professional kitchen feels like. 2016, I had the gastric sleeve. So my lifestyle for eating and everything changed. And I lost initially 60 pounds. And I worked on losing more. But at 60 pounds, that's how I was able to get the kidney.
It sounds like food brought you a lot of comfort, a lot of feeling of being able to control things that you might not otherwise be able to control, learning and growing through food and while it's comforting you. So maybe it was like not the healthiest relationship with food, but there were certainly healthy parts of it. It sounds like that brought you a lot of comfort and helped you grow into a career you really love. Where has that career as a chef taken you?
As a chef, I'm able to give other people love through food, people I don't know, and they're able to feel my love. And I think that's the most rewarding part of being a chef. From high school, I competed in competitions and won scholarships through CCAP, which gave me the drive to just move forward. I went to Johnson & Wales University, graduated, and got offered a CMT, which is a corporate manager trainee position for Hyatt, which also prepared me to be a sous chef at the age of 23. It was absolutely amazing.
That is amazing. How have you fostered your love of cooking in others?
I never imagined myself as a teacher. I never imagined myself coming back to teach. I didn't think that was in the cards. I never knew that was possible, actually. I was an average student. I was just that average kid grappling with a lot of things that's going on in my personal life. So I never thought of becoming a teacher. And then I was offered this position to teach at my alma mater. And it was crazy because I never imagined myself going back in that kitchen to teach, because I remember what my teachers went through, my chef instructor. It was crazy. And then I went back and the students loved me. And since that day, I literally use my health as a teaching tool, because although this wasn't like proven or found, they don't know when I developed chronic kidney disease. But I would imagine if I was 21 and at the third stage, I probably had it in high school. And I tell them that same story. So I educate them that using salt as your first base, let's start from aromatics. So we make everything from scratch.
You've described yourself as a food translator. What does that mean?
So I got the opportunity to go to Singapore and teach Western studies. And it was absolutely amazing. I came back with this love of Asian food. I already had a love for Asian food, but I never had a love for Asian food like I have now. While teaching for Chicago Public Schools, I saw that my students wasn't getting out of their surroundings. They often just stay within what we call their block, their city block. They wasn't going downtown. Like, they had no idea what Chinatown looked like. In Chicago, we have a melting pot of culture, you know? And so it's like all this culture around you, even if you can't afford to get out of the country or even experience another state, you can go to different neighborhoods and feel like you're not in the city of Chicago. They literally refused, but I brought that culture through food. That actually inspired Dixie Pora.
Dixie Pora is your catering company. What inspired that name?
Dixie Pora is blending my Southern background. And Pora, P-U-R-A, is the Malay spelling of Pora for Singapore. I took that because Pora represents a melting pot of Singapore, of Asia. And so I blended the two. I dreamed of it, and so it had to be true. I dreamed of everything about it, my logo, my first dish, and actually every dish since then. And people find it's weird, but I taste through my mind and I put it together, and literally I present it sometimes. And they're the first to taste it, and they're like, oh my God. So I provide extreme culinary experiences for them, like, because it takes them on a nostalgic journey, especially for people of my culture, like Black. It's important that we actually experience other cultures through food, because that's how we are connected as well. So I've introduced something like fish sauce to them, which, you know, they usually say, oh, it stink, you know, and also how to use curries, how to wake up spices, like different techniques from Asia that I took on and infuse it into food that we grew up with.
I love that, the fusion aspect and introducing people to new flavors and cultures and showing how that they can come together in something really delicious. Do you have a signature dish?
One of the dishes that came out was Ernie's fingers. I named them after my grandmother. Her name is Ernestine. She was quick to pop some cornbread with greens, like collard greens, whatever greens you make in mustard turnip, with pot liquor. Mm-hmm. So it's moist. So it was like, how can I bring that to a more formal setting, like without popping food in someone's mouth? So I made it into an egg roll.
Oh, I love it.
And then I did an Asian remoulade. It's actually the number one seller too. It's like, it's an appetizer, but I sell out all the time amongst other dishes, but that is something I sell out of. I believe my grandmother's on my shoulders.
You were diagnosed with kidney disease in 2006. How'd you learn something was wrong?
I thought my life was over. At 21, I was diagnosed with FSGS, chronic kidney disease at stage 3. Through that time, I'm like, first of all, why me? I went through that for some years. I still had moments of that at 35, actually. First of all, I'm away in Rhode Island. That's where my school was. Johnson & Wales University was in Rhode Island. So I was diagnosed that summer heading into my senior year of college. And of course, you know, what does that mean? Like for a college student, you just turned 21. My freshman year, we took a beverage course. So that, like, now my medication, like all the things I used to feel, they're like heightened now. And I don't know if it's just because of how I feel inside or if it's really starting to progress. My disease is starting to progress where drinking wasn't something I felt like doing. I actually worked two jobs to put myself through college. So I was always working plus going to school full time. So the regular average college partying, I didn't do as much. I had fun, but my fun was different. I struggled with lymphedema. I didn't know it was lymphedema until a couple years ago, actually, because we thought it was going to heal with kidney, but it didn't. So I couldn't wear like the pumps and the heel. You know, it doesn't feel comfortable. There was many times I couldn't fit a shoe on. I struggled with gout. I didn't have these names until after I had my biopsy done, which was when I moved to Minnesota. If you take that, that's a couple years later. Moving to Minnesota, having the biopsy done, it was very frightening for me. I felt very much alone because my family wasn't there. And so throughout my disease, I actually have been handling it alone. I had a great friend, Noelle, who actually stayed with me at the hospital. And then my grandmother went into the hospital that same weekend, that Sunday that I actually was released. And I got on a bus that night, the mega bus. And if you understand how painful it is after getting injected, I'm sorry, but I'm very honest with how I like my journey. But I was in so much pain. They told me to go home and lay down. I mean, I was off work for the next couple of days. You just had a long needle go into your back and you wasn't sedated at all. Like, you have to breathe so they can take it. That's it. And my grandmother passed away a couple weeks later. I got to cook for her one time. It was the Christmas of my senior year, which was 2006. And that was the first and only time I actually got to cook for her. It was a privilege to cook in her kitchen. Everybody didn't get that privilege. And I got to cook the big beef rib roast. I take a lot from her with me.
How'd that diagnosis affect your career as a chef?
I was offered a job in Singapore to come teach. But even before that, my health really started to decline. And being in the industry and we work 17-hour days, it was hard. My legs ached like nobody's business. And no one would ever know, but I deal with it when I get home. So at 25, for a long time, I actually fought with the fact that I had to give up my career for my health. But I struggled with the thought that I don't want to go to a hospital out here. It was my first time overseas. I was feeling very depressed. With the disease, I think a lot of people don't understand that sometimes chronic kidney disease weighs on you on the inside of things that you may cancel yourself out of, like it's self-doubt. I doubted that I would be able to do what everyone else did or as good as they did. It was a lot of things.
Let's fast forward to 2017. You had some pretty significant life changes.
It was a hell of a year. Also, I lost a child, which would have been 7 years ago. In December this year, it'll be 7 years. Because, again, it's like support. You have to have support with a chronic illness. You have to have support, period. So imagine with a chronic illness. And sometimes our family don't understand. They don't understand how to give the support. I mean, everybody knew that I wanted a child. I didn't try to get pregnant. I was in love with my partner at the time. I was scared. I remember like finding out I was pregnant and I was like, something ain't right. And I have a really close relationship with my nephrologist. She's been my nephrologist for 15 years now, 16 years. I remember just taking that pregnancy test and I saw like faded and she's like, let's just go and get, you know, because we've had scares before, but it was like, how is this? You know, so I just thought my body was tricking me. I don't know. I had never been pregnant, so it was shocking. And then I went to the doctor the following Monday. It was confirmed. I was pregnant. I heard the heartbeat. I was 6 weeks at that time. almost seven. And that was in April. When they did the DNC, I was 3 months and a week. I felt flutters. And some people don't understand this either, the journey. I had cravings. My craving was a high C orange. And I'm a Diet Coke person. So that was just sugar, like, you know, and I heard her heartbeat. I had a dream about her. And deep inside, I already knew I couldn't keep her. I remember going into the doctor and it was like six or seven people in there. Some were doctors, some were psychologists, because I was hysterically crying. And they were like, it's going to be okay. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know, because shouldn't you have a baby before you have a kidney, get a kidney transplant? That was what my mind, even since I was blessed to be pregnant, right? So funny story, which all connects to food. I was teaching at Washington High School during that time. All I could make, because I craved cinnamon rolls, all I could make was cinnamon rolls with my students. And it was good because it was baking time. So we were doing yeast doughs and quick breads. We made cinnamon rolls. And so I literally called her Cinnabon. May 23rd is when I had the DNC. So it was a long time in between finding out I'm pregnant and then having to schedule a surgery for them to remove the fetus. And it took me a long time to get over it. That same year that happened, May 2017, July 9th, 2017, I was actually called while I was doing vending in Humboldt Park at the Puerto Rican Museum. I was called and they said, do you want a kidney? I thought it was a prank because I didn't know they'd just outright say, do you want a kidney? It was very casual, but it was professional, but it was just like not what I expected, I guess. And I remember shaking, like you can hear trembling in my voice. Just imagine how I was before then. I was shaking. I was telling my guests, I was like, one second. I was like, you guys don't know, but I need a kidney. And they just asked me if I want a kidney. I want a kidney. And they all stopped and started praying. And they told me how fluid the list was and where I was. And I was super nervous because also I know it was something with, they worried about the antibodies or something too, because I was pregnant not long ago and everything checked out. I went in, that was a Sunday. I went in on that Monday, July 10th, and had a kidney transplant.
Does FSGS run in your family?
So 2017, I got a kidney. 2018, I met my father. Yeah.
So you had back-to-back big emotional years.
So yeah, it's kind of like, it was so much going on. So 2017, I gifted myself for Christmas ancestry. And I came in time for my birthday. So one of my struggles with going through my chronic illness is how did I get it? So 2018, I found my father. We have a great relationship. We celebrated 5 years last year. I also found his brothers, his whole family. My father actually had a kidney transplant in 2012. He's a retired police officer and he's been in Chicago this whole time and never had any idea about me. He believes though that he got it when he was in war. Now, too many of our markers line up with how we're diagnosed, FSGS. They want to do a test to see like the genetic markers, like I guess to see if it's genetic or, and I think he's kind of like reluctant, but pretty sure that it's probably hereditary.
We do see that, especially with FSGS, that it's passed down through families. And a lot of times people don't realize that it's something like FSGS. It's just explained away by other things. And, oh, well, so-and-so had a kidney transplant and so-and-so had a kidney transplant until someone actually does that genetic testing and looks at it and figures out like, yep, this is a family thing passed down. That had to probably feel emotional, but maybe good too, to find someone else who understood and you could have that connection with in your family. That had to feel probably pretty special.
I mean, I think that's appreciation right there. Like that's the connection. Being a kidney transplant patient is rewarding because I get to hopefully share with others that your life doesn't end. You know, you have so much more life to live. And no one actually knew I needed a kidney transplant until I actually announced that I was getting one, because I moved throughout life just like that. I was just normal.
How'd you work through such an emotional 2 years with pregnancy loss, transplant, and now meeting your father for the first time?
I didn't have a therapist at the time. Well, actually I did, but I didn't feel connected. So I could talk to you, but there was nothing you can do to guide me to a better thought process. it just wasn't happening. That was my first therapist. And a therapy is also taboo in my family. It's actually in my culture. Like Black African-Americans do not believe in not all. So I don't want to generalize. Don't believe in therapy. But I found a therapist in 2020 who saved my life. My doctor, Dr. Tawazan, was definitely a great support for me, because I can email her, and that's my nephrologist I talk about. She's absolutely amazing. Now, I wouldn't have made it without her, because there was times that I couldn't afford medication, and she figured it out. She figured out what you need to find, you know, and then now my transplant doctor, Dr. Ho. Listen, we've been through thick and thin. So those are like the doctors became my support. Like anytime I had an issue, I literally would call them for everything. I don't care if a bump popped up. I was that patient. They told me that they appreciated that. But I know it was nerve-wracking.
How are you feeling now post-transplant?
I could tell you, getting a kidney transplant was definitely uplifting. My skin got lighter. I still have darkness because of the anemia, but I am healthy. I move about my day normally. I live a normal life. I take my medication every day. I still get tested every month. I don't care. I know they say you can get tested every 3 months. No, I get tested every month. It's amazing. It's a journey that I didn't wish I had, but I'm glad God chose me.
It sounds like you have taken a lot of bumps in the road and a lot of challenges and turned them into a really flavorful, beautiful life where you're able to take all of those experiences, put them into a dish and share them with people. Food is so loving. It's so much more than just nourishment. There's emotion, there's culture, there's all of these things built into it. And it sounds like everything in your life is kind of culminated in this busy, it sounds like, life that you've created for yourself. So thank you so much for sharing this emotional and inspiring journey with us. And we're so grateful for you coming on and talking about these real raw things that are probably hard to talk about sometimes, but a lot of people are struggling with and dealing with, and maybe we don't hear from them as often. There are so many of those things of like, well, we don't talk about them in our family, or we don't do therapy. There's maybe some shame associated with it, but there doesn't need to be. So thank you so much, Chloe, for doing this with us today. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
If I could share just one thing to anyone who has family members dealing with chronic illnesses, not just chronic kidney disease, but any illness, even though they may seem strong, check on them. Sometimes what's in the inside don't always appear on the outside. So it's important to just check on them. Check on them and make sure that they're okay. Not just saying, are you okay? But maybe go out to lunch, go for a walk, and really have a conversation about where you are, you know? And don't try to be so invasive that you just want straight answers, but connect with them. And if I could say anything to anyone who is on the journey at the beginning, you're waiting for a kidney, life is better on the other end. So keep waiting. It will happen. Hold on to faith, eat right and eat good, right? So what does that mean? The Kidney Foundation have so many recipes already listed, how to incorporate different dishes in your lifestyle to help you navigate that journey. So look on those websites. Also, there's a lot of different chefs out here that offer those meals and stuff like that if you don't have the time, convenient meals. Also, if you're on the journey and it's getting hard and you feel like you have no one, seek therapy, give yourself grace. It is hard. It's not easy, but it's hard. And on the other end, once you pass that hump, because it's a hump, once you pass the hump, you will feel absolutely amazing. You'll be great. Like, don't think about everyone else's expectations. You just go on, live, and align yourself with what your path is.
That's great advice. Thank you, Chloe. Thank you. If you'd like to learn more about diet, nutrition, or support, visit our website, the National Kidney Foundation of Illinois, at nkfi.org. I'm Sarah Jane Castro, and this is The Journey Continues. Prevention is a key part of our mission at NKFI. That's why at the end of each episode, we offer a health or nutrition tip.
Here's today's nutrition tip about probiotics and prebiotics. As defined by the National Institutes of Health, probiotics are live microorganisms that are intended to have health benefits when consumed or applied to the body. They can be found in foods such as yogurt, fermented foods, dietary supplements, and beauty products. Probiotics help your body maintain or replenish a healthy community of microorganisms. Probiotics may also influence your body's immune response. They've been used to treat gastrointestinal conditions like antibiotic-associated diarrhea, inflammatory bowel disease, irritable bowel disease, diverticular disease, dental disorders like tooth decay and gum disease, conditions related to allergies like hay fever, asthma, atopic dermatitis, and other conditions like acne, urinary tract infections, and upper respiratory infections. If you're looking to add some probiotic-rich foods to your diet, try yogurt, buttermilk, sourdough bread, cottage cheese, kombucha, tempeh, fermented pickles, fermented sauerkraut, kimchi, or miso soup. Prebiotics come from plant fibers and aid in the growth or activity of beneficial microorganisms in your gut. Fruits, vegetables, and whole grains are especially those that contain complex carbohydrates such as fiber and resistant starch, contain most of the prebiotics in our diet. Prebiotics can help you absorb calcium, change the rate at which foods cause your blood sugar to rise, ferment foods faster to help you have regular bowel movements, and keep the cells that line your gut healthy. Foods that contain prebiotics include apples, artichokes, asparagus, bananas, barley, berries, flax seeds, garlic, green vegetables, leeks, legumes, oats, onions, tomatoes, soybeans, and wheat. Some foods may also be fortified with prebiotics, such as bread, cereals, and cookies. Try to get prebiotics from your food versus a supplement. With today's nutrition tip, I'm Melissa Prest, a registered dietitian nutritionist